Good morning, everybody. Good. Let's try that again. Good morning, everybody. Okay, good. People are ready to go. This is great. Welcome to the 15th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference. I'm Andrew Seeley. I'm the president of the Migration Policy Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning. Let me say how pleased we are at MPI to have organized this conference together with our partners at the Catholic Legal Immigration Network Clinic and Georgetown Law. This is, the 15th time we've done this. We've been partners in this endeavor the entire time. And thanks to Dean William Traynor, who you'll hear from later today, for hosting us here at Georgetown Law. And thanks especially to Professor Andy Schoenholtz for, Andy, wherever you are, Andy, there, for your partnership in this through the years, and to all the staff, actually, at Clinic and Georgetown Law and MPI that have participated in this. And we should call out particularly the events and communications staff at Georgetown Law. And I also want to single out from Clinic, Gene Atkinson and Jill Bussey, who have been fantastic partners in this effort. Good morning, good to have you here. And from our side, Doris Meisner, Musafar Chisti, and Michelle Mittelstadt, and Lisa Dixon as well. And a round of applause for all of them for putting this together. Our goal with this conference is to present a range of viewpoints that are shaping today's immigration policy debates. We believe that it's vital to have a forum where people who approach these issues from very different ideological assumptions and professional pursuits can come together and discuss immigration policy issues in a thoughtful and civil way. We make a special effort to bring together current and former policymakers, activists, academics, journalists, and others who are involved actively in discussing, debating, and deciding on immigration policy issues. It's no secret that immigration has moved to the fore in public debates and in political debates in this country. There was a recent Gallup poll that said that it was the number one issue on Americans' minds. You can believe that or not, and you can say sometimes it's a symbol for other things we're talking about, but clearly we're at a different place than we were even 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. Immigration is a front and center issue in a way that rarely has been in the history of this country, certainly the recent history. We're hopeful you'll find today's lineup of topics and speakers from multiple perspectives and positions interesting. We had to make some choices because of how salient the issues are and how many issues are on the table. And so we know we've left out some things that are important, but hopefully you'll find this a particularly useful set of issues that we've chosen to address this time. Before turning to our keynote speaker, I'd like to thank all of you for coming. We're looking forward to your active participation, your questions and comments during the sessions today. And thank you to all of those who traveled to get here. I know there's a number that came from long distances, including from California and elsewhere, to be with us today. And with that, I'm happy to welcome this year's keynote speaker, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Director Francis Cisna. He's been director of USCIS since October 2017. He served in several senior positions in the Department of Homeland Security. He was detailed to the Senate for a period of time as well and worked on the legislative side of these issues. Previously, early in his career, he was a Foreign Service officer. He worked at the U.S. Consulate in Haiti and the U.S. Embassy in Sweden on immigration and visa matters, and he was a lawyer in private practice as well. Throughout, he's been known for his incredibly detailed knowledge of immigration policy and law. Since he earned his law degree right here at Georgetown Law, we're delighted to welcome him back to a place where undoubtedly he spent many days and nights bent over the law books preparing for his career. This session will be moderated by my colleague Doris Meisner, who needs no introduction in this group, which won't prevent me from introducing her. Doris is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute and the director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program, also twice commissioner of Immigration Naturalization Service, first as acting commissioner under Ronald Reagan and later as confirmed commissioner under President Clinton. With that, let me turn it over to Director Cisna. Welcome. Good to have you here today.
Well, good morning, everybody. We have a lot to talk about, and I'm going to try to get through as much as I can in the next 25 minutes or so, and then we'll take some questions. I think maybe take some questions from Doris, from the panel, and then maybe open it up if there's time to people from the audience as well. So again, good morning. I would like to thank MPI and Clinic for inviting me to be part of this 15th Immigration Law and Policy Conference. I've attended this conference myself many times as a DHS official and as a private citizen in the past, so I'm intimately familiar with the conference and what a good experience it should be for all of you as well. I've been the director at CIS, as Andrew said, for almost a year, and I'm proud of the work we're doing to administer the nation's lawful immigration system. We have as our other mission goals safeguarding the integrity of that immigration system and, of course, protecting the homeland on behalf of the American people, which is a mission goal that echoes one of the goals of DHS proper. My three main priorities for USCIS focus on homeland security, faithfully administering our nation's immigration laws, and moving the agency into an electronic world. More specifically, I want to bring USCIS into the 1990s. I want us to get there and from a technological perspective, get us right there so that we are where we should be. I will go through a number of current policies and issues that you all are probably very familiar with, and I believe my comments will demonstrate USCIS's commitment to those three priorities. First, the issue of public charge. You've probably all heard in the news about the proposed public charge regulation and what that might mean for immigration in this country. I would like to speak a little bit about that now and how I view this regulation, a proposed regulation. Self-sufficiency has been a basic principle of U.S. immigration legislation since the earliest immigration laws. Indeed, you probably may know that at the time of the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, there was a part of that law that was codified in U.S. statute, I think it's 8 U.S.C. 1601, where the Congress set forth several principles of self-sufficiency for immigrants. And going back to the late 1880s, the public charge ground of inadmissibility has been in law and has, to different levels over the course of the time since then, been enforced. Despite this long history, public charge has not been defined in statute or in regulations, and there has been insufficient guidance on how to determine if a foreign national who is applying for a visa, admission, or adjustment of status is likely at any time to become a public charge. Federal law generally requires that the foreign national seeking to come to or remain in the United States be able to support themselves financially and not be dependent on the public to meet their needs. Specifically, Section 212A4 of the INA, the Immigration and Nationality Act, makes inadmissible, quote, any alien who, in the opinion of the consular officer at the time of application for a visa, or in the opinion of the Secretary of Homeland Security or the Attorney General, at the time of application for admission or adjustment of status, is likely at any time to become a public charge. Inadmissibility based on the public charge ground is determined by considering at least the mandatory factors that are set forth in Section 212A4 and making a prospective determination of the applicant's likelihood of becoming a public charge. This determination is based on a review of the totality of the alien's circumstances, including these mandatory factors: age, health, family status, assets, resources, and financial status. Family status, assets, resources, and financial status, and education and skills. The statute also permits the consideration of a sufficient affidavit of support. DHS recently posted to its website a notice of proposed rulemaking related to the public charge grant of inadmissibility. The proposed rule, I don't think, has been published yet in the Federal Register, but it should be very soon, within days, if it hasn't already been today or Friday. The proposed rule, if finalized, would change the standard that DHS uses when determining whether an alien is likely at any time to become a public charge and is therefore inadmissible and ineligible for a visa, admission, or adjustment of status. The proposed rule, once published, will allow the public to comment for 60 days and provide input on how the public charge grant of admissibility should be administered. This rule, if finalized, would apply to aliens seeking admission to the U.S. from abroad on immigrant or non-immigrant visas, aliens seeking to adjust their status to that of a lawful permanent resident from within the United States, and aliens within the United States who hold a non-immigrant visa and seek to either extend their stay or change their non-immigrant status. This rule would not impact the vulnerable alien populations the Congress exempted from the public charge ground of inadmissibility, including refugees, asylees, special immigrant juveniles, trafficking and crime victims, VAWA beneficiaries, and certain other beneficiaries of humanitarian programs. In addition, DHS is proposing to limit how the rule would apply to active duty and reserve members of the military and their spouses and children, as well as certain children of the U.S. who will acquire citizenship upon admission in the U.S. or shortly thereafter. It is incumbent upon the U.S. government to evaluate applications in a manner consistent with federal law, and I believe the public charge regulation is a necessary step to achieving that goal. Indeed, that regulation is necessary. As I just said, there is no definition for public charge in the statute or in the regulations. An attempt was made back in the late 1990s a proposed rule was published back then, but never finalized. I think this regulation, for the first time, will definitively state what that means, what public charge means. The statutory provision at 212A4 is there. It is a grant of inadmissibility. It needs to be administered, and we can't administer it or enforce it if there's no definition, if there's no standard according to which to administer it. So I think it is appropriate and correct that we issue this regulation. And it is appropriate that the regulation be put out for public comment for 60 days. So during that period, please comment away. And I anticipate we'll get an enormous volume of comments given the great interest in this regulation. And we look forward to them, genuinely. We will take the time we need to go through all the comments and put out a final rule as quickly as possible thereafter. But for right now, as soon as the reg is published, and like I say, it should be imminently, please do comment. Next, I'd like to talk briefly about humanitarian benefits and our mission in that regard a little generally, specifically refugees and asylum. The United States is a global leader when it comes to assisting individuals fleeing persecution, including refugees and asylum seekers. To appreciate the extent of our nation's generosity, we must look at our humanitarian response as a whole to include an accounting of our asylum program. Each year, the United States provides protection to tens of thousands of new asylees and allows those awaiting adjudication of their cases to remain in the United States. Right now, there are roughly 700,000 total asylum cases awaiting adjudication when you combine the 320,000 or so that are in the USCIS backlog with the roughly similar number that is in the Department of Justice Immigration Court backlog. In addition, USCIS recently expanded the availability of citizenship preparation services throughout the country with two grant opportunities of $10 million. For refugees and asylees, one of the grant opportunities will fund four organizations to provide individualized services to lawful permanent residents who entered the United States under the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program or were granted asylum. This is a new feature of the grant program that many of you are familiar with, doubtless. As you recall, in previous years, we would allocate an amount of money. Sometimes it was statutorily appropriated. Now it isn't, so it's, you know, we take it out of our fee funds. But the amount presently is about $10 million. And a number of organizations apply and receive the grant monies for services in helping aliens naturalize. This year, for the first time, we wanted to set aside some of the grant money for organizations that help people naturalize who originally came in as asylees and refugees. So focusing on that population, again, this is a new thing, and I imagine it will expand in future years, but for now we have four organizations that will be funded under that new prong of the grant program. Refugees more specifically. The refugee resettlement process is a multi-agency effort that involves the Department of State, Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, and DHS, and our vetting partners in the intelligence and law enforcement community. While the Department of State manages the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, USCIS is the one that conducts the interviews overseas and is responsible for determining who is eligible to resettle as a refugee in the United States. Throughout the refugee program's history, we have continually looked for ways to improve, refine, and streamline the security vetting process for refugee applicants. This administration recognizes that nothing is more important than protecting our national security. Over the past year, at the direction of the President, USCIS, together with the Department of State, federal law enforcement, and the intelligence community, conducted extensive reviews and introduced new measures to make the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program more secure. While necessary, those changes have increased the time that it takes to process refugees for resettlement. With respect to setting the annual refugee ceiling, the proposed refugee resettlement ceiling for fiscal year 2019 takes into account the operational realities associated with implementing these new security measures to protect national security and public safety. To repeat, though the number is not final yet, the president has not signed the proclamation for the refugee number for the next fiscal year. Whatever that number is, it will absolutely be driven principally by the capacity of my agency and the law enforcement security vetting partners that my agency interacts with in vetting and screening refugees to ensure that that number is not a fictitious number. It has to be a real number based on operational reality and how many people we think that we really are going to be able to admit in the next fiscal year. Now, how many people we're going to interview or how many people we're going to process, how many people will be admitted in the next fiscal year, or we think will be admitted, given operational reality. Asylum. One of the operational challenges we are currently addressing is the historically unprecedented surge in the number of aliens seeking asylum in the United States. UNHCR notes that the United States led the world in a number of new asylum applications in 2017. Since fiscal year 2009, USCIS has approved more than 100,000 applications for asylum for persons already in the United States. According to Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, before 2013, approximately one out of every 100 arriving aliens claimed credible fear and sought asylum in the United States. Today, it's one out of every 10 claims credible fear. In fiscal year 2017, CBP apprehended nearly 100,000 families from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Of those, nearly 99% remain in the United States today. The number of asylum cases pending adjudication by USCIS has swelled by more than 850% since the end of fiscal year 2013, as a result of the increased number of affirmative asylum filings by unaccompanied minors and the tripling in the overall number of new affirmative asylum filings during the same five-year period. Lengthy backlogs in asylum processing can undermine the integrity of our asylum system and reward systemic fraud and abuse. They delay the legal protections for individuals with valid asylum claims for years. Since early 2017, USCIS has been detailing refugee officers to assist the asylum division with challenges associated with surges at the U.S. southern border, where migrants know that they can exploit a broken system to enter the U.S., avoid removal, and remain in the country. Members of the refugee corps have demonstrated the highest level of professionalism during the recent period when the extraordinary circumstances on the border have required many of them to be detailed to asylum offices or to the border region to work on credible fear screenings. Supplementing asylum operations with qualified officers borrowed from the refugee corps is a good way to increase capacity quickly, particularly when responding to the crisis on our southern border, which is exacerbated by a broken asylum system. However, the more efficient and effective organizational model is to focus staff on doing the work that they were hired to do. We are working very hard to equip the asylum division with permanent staff, sufficient permanent staff, to address its workload needs so that the refugee corps staff can focus on refugee resettlement work. However, we will continue to detail some refugee officers to assist with asylum work on a smaller ad hoc scale in the next fiscal year. Let me say on that, the situation we find ourselves now with respect to asylum processing, and in particular the credible fear cases that we see at the southern border, are indeed substantial. The flow of people that we have to process for credible fear claims is, I think, potentially going to exceed the highest level of credible fear cases we saw, which is back in fiscal year 2016. We may be by the end of this fiscal year, which is, well, it already ended. When we see the numbers, it may be that we reach approximately 900,000 credible fear cases that we processed. This is incredible, and it is a huge number, as I say, that rivals, if doesn't exceed, the number that we had in fiscal year 16. This has put an extraordinary strain on the asylum system. As I said, we have had to move people from refugee to asylum work to help handle that. I went down to the southern border a couple months ago and talked to the credible fear screeners down there. The circumstances in which they work are challenging, but as I said, they remain highly professional and dedicated to their work. I hope, I anticipate that the refugee officers should not have to be detailed that much longer to the asylum work in fiscal year 19, but we shall see. At the same time, we are hiring up in the asylum division to ensure, as I said, that all the USCIS staff working on both ends of the humanitarian work that I just described do what they were hired to do. Another reform that we recently implemented just a few months ago to help our processing of the affirmative asylum claims is last in, first out. This means that we have the 320,000 case backlog, but we still have incoming cases that are flowing at a large rate, and we want to stay on top of the incoming cases, diverting resources to that for now, taking cases as they come in and adjudicating them as quickly as possible, hoping that the backlog doesn't increase. And we have had success with this. In the past few weeks, the past couple of months, the cases that have been coming in, the affirmative asylum cases, we have stayed on top of, and we've been able to adjudicate all those cases within normal processing times. The backlog of 320,000 cases, for the first time in many years, was actually reduced a couple weeks ago, and it keeps on reducing in small numbers, but the point is it reduced for the first time in a long time. I think last in, first out, LIFO is paying dividends, and I know that this technique of addressing asylum backlogs was pioneered back in the 90s during Ms. Meisner's tenure, and I actually would commend MPI's recent report on recommendations for fixing the asylum system, which came out last week, I think it was. Mm-hmm. It was a very good report. I read the whole thing. There's some good recommendations in there, and we will take a look seriously at MPI's recommendations. Another matter relating to this that you're all familiar with is the matter of AB decision. On June 11th, 2018, the Attorney General published a precedent decision called Matter of AB, which addresses what asylum applicants must demonstrate to show that they were persecuted or have a well-founded fear of persecution based upon their membership in a so-called particular social group. Shortly thereafter, USCIS issued formal implementation guidance to asylum and refugee officers on how to apply that decision while processing reasonable fear, credible fear, asylum and refugee claims. I think at this time, we're looking at the nature of the cases that are coming across the border to determine what impact Matter of AB has had or will have. It's not entirely clear yet what that impact will be, but we're monitoring statistics to determine that. In the meantime, our officers are implementing it, administering it, and as they should, because it is a precedent decision. Very quickly, a few other points, some odds and ends that I know are of interest. Requests for evidence. A 2013 policy memorandum, a USCIS policy memorandum, limited denials without requests for evidence or notices of intent to deny, of intent to deny, or NOIDs, unless there was, quote, no possibility, unquote, of approval. This no possibility policy limited the adjudicator's discretion to adjudicate cases based on the record. The effect of the no possibility policy was that only statutory denials, such as a denial where a non-existent benefit was requested, would be issued without an RFE or a NOID. As I've traveled to the field offices around the country, the USCIS field offices, adjudicators have repeatedly asked to have their prior discretion returned to them. The USCIS issued a new policy memorandum in July, just a couple months ago, that removes the no possibility language and restores the discretion to adjudicators to deny applications, petitions, and requests without first issuing an RFE that they have always had under the regulations. Note that this new policy memorandum does not apply to DACA and certain types of other cases. This policy change is part of an ongoing effort to protect the integrity of our laws, cut down on frivolous filings, and help ensure legitimate petitioners aren't undermined by those gaming the system. Put differently, the restoring the ability of adjudicators to issue or to just deny without issuing requests for evidence, particularly in cases where people are not filing complete cases, they're filing skeletal petitions, skeletal applications. Those types of applications and petitions clog the system and take valuable time, adjudicator time away from adjudicating good cases that are properly filed, that the alien or the petitioner has spent time marshaling the necessary documentation that the regulations require. This is meant to improve the process, streamline case handling system, and have adjudicators, as I say, have more time to handle the cases that merit it. Notices to appear. On June 28th of this year, USCIS released updated guidance for issuing notices to appear. Now, to be clear, USCIS has always had the authority to issue notices to appear. We were delegated that authority way back in 2003 by Secretary Ridge when DHS was first created. USCIS issued approximately 91,000 notices to appear in fiscal year 2017. And we issued approximately 58,800 NTAs in quarters 1 and 2 of fiscal year 2018. So again, USCIS has always been issuing NTAs by the tens of thousands year after year. This is not a new authority. But starting today, October 1st, USCIS will begin implementing the updated NTA policy. Under the new guidance, USCIS officers will now issue an NTA for a wider range of cases where the individual is removable and there is evidence of fraud, criminal activity, or where an applicant is denied an immigration benefit and is unlawfully present in the country. Through the new NTA policy memo, USCIS is carrying out the President's executive order on enhancing public safety in the interior of the United States, which establishes immigration policies for enhancing public safety and articulates the priorities for removing individuals from the United States, promoting national security and the integrity of the immigration system. Again, this is not something new. What is new is that we are expanding the categories of people who are going to be receiving NTAs to, most principally, people who apply for a benefit and have no underlying lawful status when that benefit is denied. If you don't have a lawful status, you should be NTA'd. And that is the fundamental principle of our policy with regard to that population. Finally, let me touch on the what we call the historical fingerprint enrollment process. Since I am noting the focus on cases with fraud and criminal activity, I would like to address a misperception and misreporting in the news about USCIS's role in denaturalization cases. What the agency is working on is a continuation from the previous administration in what is known as Operation Janus. In 2011, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, first searched databases to identify aliens who were fugitives, convicted criminals, or had orders of deportation going back to the 1990s. As a result, ICE identified 315,000 such people whose fingerprint records were not in the automated biometric identification system, or IDENT. ICE started working on uploading those records to IDENT by scanning the fingerprint cards and putting them into the electronic system. In 2016, the DHS Inspector General's office issued a report finding that USCIS had naturalized people whose old fingerprint cards had not been digitized. People who had been previously deported and re-entered under a different identity and then went on to somehow become naturalized years later. The Office of Inspector General identified hundreds of cases where that had happened. After the report, during the previous administration, USCIS began identifying people who naturalized after having been ordered removed and intentionally used multiple identities to defraud the government to obtain U.S. citizenship. USCIS established an office in the Los Angeles area to serve as a centralized location to review and refer such appropriate cases to DOJ for civil denaturalization. Since January 2017, USCIS has identified approximately 2,500 cases requiring review, and as of August 31st, we have referred more than 110 of those cases to the Department of Justice. So far, 6 individuals have received a final denaturalization court order based on that work. Now, let me finish on this and then we can take some questions. There is no denaturalization task force. I can't repeat that. I don't know how many times I repeat that. There's press in the room for the 10,000th time. There is no denaturalization task force. This is a group of adjudicators, or rather officers and lawyers, who are looking at the cases that were identified by ICE of people who illegally entered the country, got deported, and then illegally entered again under a fake identity, and then years later lied to get citizenship. It is appropriate and correct that those people be denaturalized. That is the population we're talking about. We are not opening up naturalization boxes and, you know, finding people's files and looking for missing commas or missing semicolons. This is the population we're going after. That's it. It's based on a DHS, Office of Inspector General report from 2016, which you can all read, and based on work that goes back years beyond that, where CBP and ICE found that this was a problem. I hope that puts that to rest. And with that, let me open it to some questions from Doris, and maybe we can take some from the audience in the time that we have left.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Director, and thank you for being specific about a number of important points that I know people are interested in and that have been very topical. I have a couple of questions because we were asked to give people an opportunity to submit questions on cards, and then while we get mics positioned, the director will take questions from the floor as well. So I'm going to start with a question that has to do with your point at the beginning that you're bringing the agency into the 21st, we hope, century. Mm-hmm. And how that relates to processing times, because we are seeing longer processing times and sometimes many more requests for further information, et cetera. So could you talk to us a little bit about that whole part of your efforts?
Yes, this is a critical part of my directorship. I've been focusing on this since the first day, and that is that by the first, and most importantly, by the end of 2020, USCIS will be electronic. We will be completely electronic. Hopefully the paper will be gone, and we'll be able to take everything electronically. From your perspective, all you have to worry about is that the intake is going to be purely electronic. On the inside, we'll deal with that and figure out how to take those cases in. But that is going to happen. That is going to happen. The paper will end by the end of 2020. Indeed, some form types before that time, we may roll out. I mean, some right now, you can apply electronically already. You can apply for citizenship through LS right now. But the what will happen is all form types will be available electronically before the end of 2020. Now, as you can imagine, when that happens, this will produce incredible efficiencies for the agency. We'll be able to manage our workload better. We'll be able to assign work across the entire country to different offices better. I think that will just be an enormous boon towards reducing the backlogs which USCIS and the predecessor INS have groaned under for decades. It's just a perennial problem because, you know, it takes time to catch up to backlogs, and given the way that the agency is self-funded through fees, it's very hard to stay on top of and keep catching up with backlogs and incoming flow. But we're working hard on it. We've increased staff in the field office operations directorate and in service center operations. We plan to keep working, as I just said, in asylum to hire more people to work on the backlog there. This is a problem. We're keenly aware of it. I don't like it, but it's a perennial problem of the agency. But I tell you, when we get all electronic by the end of 2020, well, I mean, that'll be a different world. And I look forward to that, and I hope you do too.
I think we all do. Are there questions from the audience, and where are the microphones? Okay, up here. Please tell us who you are, and wait, here it comes.
Yeah, if you can speak in the mic.
Sure. Right. My name is Xavier Francis. I'm an attorney at the Erickson Immigration Group in Arlington, Virginia. Regarding the RFE policy changes, you said that the purpose of the recent policy memo was to eliminate frivolous or placeholder petitions. But can you speak a little bit about the discretion that will be given to adjudicating officers to make the determination as to whether a petition is frivolous or is a placeholder? How much discretion will that person be given, and is there any type of operational guidance that will be issued to help adjudicators make that determination?
There is internal operational guidance, and remember, the whole purpose of this is to ensure that the first thing that the adjudicator looks at is whether all the regulatorily required elements of the petition or application or whatever it is are present. And then to make an assessment if something is missing, at that point, whether to issue the RFE or not. And yes, there is operational guidance on what types of, you know, what types of things adjudicators should have in mind when making that determination. So no, it is not going to be just just a whim or caprice of the adjudicator whether to issue the RFE or not. But I think the principal thing that you all should take away from this is please file whatever case or petition, application, whatever it is you're filing, with all the required regulatory criteria elements. We put up at the time that this was rolled out a month or so, a couple weeks ago, on the websites for each of the different form types, checklists of all the different things the regs require for each of those types of applications or petitions. So if those of you who are lawyers or those of you who represent aliens or entities that are filing such things, take a look at those and ensure that everything is present. It is not the case that just because one thing is missing, you are automatically going to get denied. That is false. The adjudicator will make a determination, based on common sense and just, I think, good internal training on what merits an RFE, what doesn't merit an RFE. The adjudicators are professionals. They are not trying to find ways to deny cases. We want to adjudicate cases correctly and as efficiently as possible. That is what the RFE policy is about.
Okay, do I see other hands in the audience? I guess we're over here still. Why don't we go over to that section on the right?
Hi, my name is Arvind Bhadupali, and my question is about the public charge rule. So what do you think are the expected impacts from the chilling effects on immigrants not signing up for public benefits due to fears that their residency petitions might be disadvantaged?
Well, there's a number of factors there. I think first, historically, is my understanding that back in 1996, when the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 was passed, a lot of people unsubscribed from public benefits. In many cases, wrongly, because they didn't have to. I think in this case, I would just implore you to look at the proposed rule carefully. Note that not all public benefits are, to use the term, counted against the receipt of not all types of public benefits is counted against the alien for public charge determination purposes. There's a list of benefits that's in the proposed rule that we will look at if you received it or are likely to receive it. Remember, it's prospective, and it's not all benefits. So there should not be a mad rush to unsubscribe from all benefits. That is unwarranted, I think. People should look carefully at the public charge proposal rule to see exactly, truly, what we're looking at when making that assessment. The other thing I would note is that the population of aliens in this country who are eligible to receive public benefits under the 1996 Welfare Reform Act is tiny. You have to be a qualified alien, which is a term of art under that law, and that includes lawful permanent residents, people who are paroled in for more than a year, certain asylees and refugees, but not non-immigrants, and very small number of people can actually get it, and you have to have been here at least 5 years before you can get means-tested benefits. So the population of people that we're talking about that are on benefits right now would be very small. Again, this is a prospective assessment that we're looking at. Is it likely that the person in the future will be taking public benefits at the time, and we look at that at the time that we're assessing their adjustment of status application. So again, I would just say, be careful, look at, and don't just rely on newspaper accounts or misguided media commentary. Look at the proposed rule and tell the people that you help in the public to look at that and not panic. It's very clearly laid out what we're gonna look at and what we're not gonna look at.
Okay, I'm gonna ask the final question from the ones that were submitted in advance because this goes to a broader policy issue, and it has to do with TPS. And the fact that most of the TPS programs that have been in place for varying periods of time, some of them quite long, are going to be running out. What's your expectation from a USCIS standpoint about the termination of TPS programs and what is likely to happen to those people and to the work of your agency?
Well, I think as those TPS programs expire, the ones that have been already terminated, but with the long expiration phase out window, I mean, I don't know what to say. I mean, people have immigration options open to them. I'm not going to give legal counsel from the podium on what they can or can't do, but there are avenues of relief that I'm sure many of you are thinking of in your head as I speak to people with TPS who then get off of TPS. If people avail themselves of those different avenues, it may be that the agency experiences an increase in workload to handle those cases. More than that, I really don't want to get into because it's under litigation, but I will just say that people do, under the law, have avenues open to them depending on their circumstances, even if they lose their TPS status.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much. Thanks for being with us. Could you all please join me in thanking the director?